Thanks so much for joining us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Today, for the next hour, we're going to be talking about what healthy sleep looks like and how you can get it. And with us today, Dr. Rick Blackburn. Dr. Blackburn is a behavioral health sleep medicine director at Nystrom and Associates Counseling in New Brighton, Minnesota. Dr. Blackburn is a licensed psychologist, board certified in behavioral sleep medicine. How does the quality of sleep you get at night affect your daily life? Maybe the strategies you use to wind down at night. Dr. Rick Blackburn, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you for the invite. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start simply. Why do people need sleep?
Well, that's not really a simple question. And the truth is, we really don't know fully why we sleep. We have research showing that sleep is restorative when we're in the deepest stages of sleep, called slow wave sleep. Our body releases human growth hormone that helps restore cells, helps with growth in children, and restores hair and nails. It does provide minimal energy conservation, but we really only save about 370 calories by sleeping. We know sleep helps regulate our immune system, it helps with memory consolidation, and it activates the lymphatic system. And the lymphatic system is really a relatively new discovery, but basically when we're in slow-wave sleep, our ventricles in our brain enlarge, and it pulls the spinal fluid up into the brain, and then when we leave slow-wave sleep, it pushes it down, and they found that it's filled with beta amyloid, which are parts that causes the plaques and tangles in Alzheimer's disease. So sleep does clean our brain out.
Wow. And what about the day-to-day behavior? You know, if you're deprived of sleep, what do you see in your research relating to this? How it affects our behavior?
Yeah, well, it really affects our performance and our vigilance or ability to pay attention to things. We know that if people sleep after learning something, like a high school student or a college student, the memory is more likely to be remembered. We know that in sleep, our memory consolidates with other memories, making it more accessible. But what most people will notice is that they have a harder time focusing. They have less attention that they can direct at specific things, and that can lead to performance impairments, but also lead to workplace accidents.
Oh. So what controls when and how you sleep?
Okay, so sleep is actually governed by two forces that oppose each other. One is called process S, or sleep drive. But essentially, when we're awake, our brain is accumulating chemicals that make us feel increasingly sleepy. Most adults need to be awake about 16 consecutive hours to have enough pressure to sleep through the night, but some people need to be awake a little bit longer. Now, if this sleep pressure was the only thing governing sleep, we'd be a lot like a newborn. We'd be awake for a couple hours, sleep for a while, wake up again, and all day long we'd have this on-again, off-again wakefulness. So our body has a circadian alerting signal, and basically when you open your eyes in the morning, the light turns on this system and it starts a new 24-hour cycle. But the time that you get up has to be fairly constant. This alerting signal runs off the same chemicals that stress, fear, and anxiety run on, and we think that actually was an adaptive function. I mean, if you were being chased by a pack of wolves, you wouldn't want to suddenly fall asleep. But this alerting signal peaks for most adults around 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and then it starts to drop off. And then sleep pressure takes over, and that's what pulls us into sleep.
So I guess, how do you tell for sure if you're not getting enough sleep? I guess attention, the things that you've described probably come to the fore.
Yeah. So sleep need varies by individual and by age. So most adults need about 7 to 9 hours of sleep per night. Some need a little bit more, some need a little bit less. But in general, we're awake about two-thirds of a 24-hour period and sleep for a third. However, you should be in the age range or the amount of sleep for your age range that's appropriate. But then the second side of it is that you should feel well rested during the day. And so some people have other sleep disorders or they're on medications that may interfere with feeling well rested during the day. But in general, your sleep should be enough for you to feel refreshed and able to go about your daily activities.
You might be waking up in the middle of the night, let's say every night at 3 or something in the morning. What are some reasons that this happens?
Well, waking up at 3 a.m. is probably very familiar to people who are horror movie buffs. because all bad things happen at 3 a.m. in horror movies. And what's true is, for eons, people would wake up between 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, and before we could explain it as a biological function, they said there were evil spirits out doing mischievous things, and they dubbed it the witching or the voodoo hour. The truth is that when we fall asleep, our body temperature drops throughout the night, which pulls us deeper into sleep. And then around 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning for most people, the body temperature starts to rise. And whenever body temperature starts to tick upward, we tend to wake up. Think about that fitful sleep you have when you're running a temperature. The other thing that happens around that time is your body starts releasing cortisol to prepare you for waking up. So if you wake up in that 3 to 4 hour range and you maybe go to the bathroom and then go back to sleep, that's not a problem. But it's when you wake up and then you can't get back to sleep that can really disrupt your day.
Yeah, why does that happen? I mean, I've had that happen to me many times over my life. You wake up at midnight or 1 a.m. or whatever, and then you go back, and most times I go right back to sleep. I can go back to sleep in a few minutes, but there are times when I might be up for another hour.
Yeah. And so sleep is really complex. You know, if you wake up and your mind is thinking about something or if you're worrying about something, that can keep you up. The other thing is that we get older, our clock tends to shift earlier so that we prefer to fall asleep earlier and wake up earlier. And that's just a normal part of aging. But it can get to where people, no matter what time they go to sleep, they're going to wake up at that time and not get back to sleep. And that can be a sign of a sleep disorder.
Okay. And speaking of that, Martin in Ripon emailed us. Martin would like to point out the importance of having an overnight sleep test. And that may relate to what you were just sort of getting at there. Martin had one in 2018. Which disclosed that Martin did not have sleep apnea, but that Martin's heart rate was slowing down dramatically during sleep. And this problem was then addressed successfully, but Martin might never have known of the problem until it was too late without the sleep test.
Right. And sleep tests get to be kind of a difficult thing now. So it's called a polysomnogram. And basically, you have to meet certain criteria to qualify for a sleep study like Martin had. And there's lots of things like ruling out sleep apnea or cardiac issues or abnormal behaviors during the night that justify it. But it's not something that your average person can just say, I want a sleep study to see what's going on. There has to be a problem first.
Yeah. How is insomnia treated these days?
So, unfortunately, insomnia is still treated the way it usually has been in most cases, which is you go to your doctor, they give you a handout on sleep hygiene, and maybe a medication for a sleeping pill. However, that's not the recommended treatment for adult insomnia. So in 2005, the National Institutes of Health declared that cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI, should be the first-line treatment for adult insomnia. In 2016, the American College of Physicians, which is the doctor group your primary care provider probably belongs to, reviewed all the treatments for insomnia, including medicines, homeopathic, naturalistic remedies, over-the-counters, and they found that CBTI was the safest, most effective, and most durable treatment for insomnia, and they recommended, too, that it be the first-line treatment. The problem is there aren't a lot of us out there treating insomnia with CBTI. So even though it's the recommended treatment, there just aren't enough providers available.
And so CBTI, again, to make that more plain, is?
So basically what we do is we manipulate the psychological, physiological elements that control sleep. So we use controlled sleep deprivation to first get the person to fall asleep quickly and stay asleep. And then once they're able to sleep efficiently, then we gradually expand the opportunity for sleep until they're getting the sleep they need that's appropriate for their age and they feel well rested during the day.
Cool. Okay, Dr. Rick Blackburn, our guest today. Behavioral Health Sleep Medicine Director at Nystrom and Associates Counseling in New Brighton, Minnesota, licensed psychologist as well. It's great to have him with us. Are you getting enough sleep? Do you have problems with it? Have you overcome those problems? I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about sleep now, the importance of getting a good night's sleep, and what if you're not, how can you get it with our guest, Dr. Rick Blackburn. Lots of experience in this area he has. He is the Behavioral Health Sleep Medicine Director at Nystrom and Associates Consulting in New Brighton, Minnesota, licensed psychologist. It's great to have him with us. I know we have lots of callers online, and we have some emails as well. Bobby emailed us, magnesium an hour before bed. After years of bad sleep, it has Bobby sleeping 6 or 7 hours straight. So magnesium.
Yeah, magnesium can be beneficial for sleep. It has a somewhat soothing, relaxing quality. It helps certain vitamins and minerals get into your system. When combined with a little calcium, it can help the calcium absorb. It is, for most people, relatively benign. Does it have a lot of power to help sleep? Not according to research, but then you hear cases like Bobby, who says it made a world of difference, and that's just because sleep is unique in every individual.
Yeah, absolutely. Felix in Reedstown, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Felix.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Are you able to hear me?
Yes. You're coming in loud and clear.
Sounds good. Well, real quick, the elevator speech is I've got severe PTSD, and as part of that, I've got dissociative sleep eating, where I wake up in the middle of the night, and because I ignore my body's interoceptive signals during the day, I don't see myself as eating food in a conscious state, either going into sleep or between sleep. I'm doing complicated food activities like using knives and eating cheese because it's Wisconsin. But the doctors think that the severity of the PTSD is related to at least the sleep eating, and that there's not a lot of awareness around how dissociative impacts from PTSD at least can relate to sleep. And yet this is not technically a sleep disorder, in my understanding, because of it being related primarily to the mental health, and I wanted to spread some awareness around that.
Oh, Felix, thanks for calling. Comments on that, Dr. Blackburn?
Yeah, so Felix, it is a sleep disorder. It's called sleep-related eating disorder. And people with PTSD do have more of it, and it can happen in a dissociative state. Sometimes medications that we're taking to help with sleep or to help with our PTSD can also cause us to do things that we don't remember. They can use low-dose clonazepam to help you not act out or eat while you're sleeping. But there's also environmental controls, like putting a lock on the refrigerator. The part with dangerous utensils is concerning because people can and have hurt themselves. And so, again, it might be environmental controls, like putting child locks on the knife cupboard, just so that there's one more thing that intervenes between you and potentially hurting yourself. But if it does get severe, you can go see a sleep physician, and there are some treatments out there that can help.
All right. Felix, thank you for calling. Barbara in Fort Atkinson, your turn.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, how long should it take a person to go to sleep after they're in the bed, and what is a definition of insomnia?
Okay. So for most people, it usually takes between 10 and 30 minutes to fall asleep. You know, when we do sleep therapy, we're aiming for around 20 minutes, but definitionally, it's not insomnia if you're falling asleep in less than 30 minutes. How quickly you fall asleep can be signs of other problems, though. So if you're falling asleep the minute your head hits the pillow, that's either a sign of severe sleep deprivation, or you might have a disorder like obstructive sleep apnea, where your body is so tired it just shuts down. And the reason that's concerning is because that can happen during the day, during quiet moments, like when you're at a stoplight driving, or you're sitting in a boring meeting at work. But normally, a normal time to fall asleep is between 10 and 30 minutes. The definition of insomnia is that you either have difficulties falling asleep, staying asleep, or you wake up too early and can't get back to sleep, or some combination of them, and it causes daytime impairment and distress. And it's not due to another sleep disorder or a medication or something like that. It needs to occur at least 3 days a week for more than 3 months.
All right. There you go, Barbara. Thank you very much for calling. Dustin in Central Wisconsin, it's your turn. Hi, Dustin.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Excuse me.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
So I got clean from opiates in January 16th, 2016. Since then, I have been, I guess, up and down on good sleep. And my question would be where to start, I guess, in general. So I have, for myself, gotten into a good rhythm where I do go to sleep at the same time every night. I tend to wake up at the same time every morning. But the issues that I'm having are exactly what you were just speaking of, as where about 1, 2 o'clock I tend to wake up, just use the restroom, and I cannot fall back asleep. And again, I don't know if that goes hand in hand with the drug addiction that was, you know, for 15-plus years, and typically it would just knock myself out. So it took a long time to get used to sleeping, you know, without the drugs. I know that's pretty broad, but I'm going to leave it there and let you go and listen to your answer.
All right. Thanks, Dustin.
Before you go, Dustin, how old are you?
Yeah. I'm 38.
38. Okay. So sleep disorders are actually many times a precursor to an addictive disorder. So people are self-medicating using a drug like opiates to help them get to sleep. When they're on the medications, it messes with sleep. The opiates can cause central sleep apnea, where the brain just doesn't get the signal to breathe. And then once you enter into recovery, sleep generally improves, but for some people it doesn't, or it's slow to improve. And we know that poor sleep is often a relapse trigger. So if I were you and you're having that early morning awakening, I would come and see a sleep specialist like myself or one of the other ones at Nystrom's or somewhere near you, because they can treat that using cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And that has shown to be effective for people who are in recovery.
Ah, Dustin, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You have, I think, six ways, or maybe we could call them rules, to help people improve their sleep. What are they?
So they're formally called the six rules of stimulus control. And so in 1972, it was discovered by a researcher in Arizona. And there are six rules that help cement our circadian clocks and control our sleep pressure. And for most people, if they follow these six rules, within a couple months, they'll start sleeping better. If they don't, then that's a sign they should see a sleep specialist. So the first rule is to get up at the same time every day. The time that we wake up controls the speed of our clock, and it resets it for a 24-hour period, because not everyone's clock runs 24 hours. So if you get up at various times of the day or sleep in by a couple hours, you can get what's called social jet lag, which is essentially like jet lag, only you're not going someplace different. We want the bed to be used for sleeping and intimacy only. Don't read, watch TV, or do other things in bed. What that's doing is it's training your mind to be awake and alert while you're in bed. When you get into bed, the bed should be a signal that it's time for sleep and not some other activities. The third rule is that anytime you're awake for 20 minutes or longer, get up and do something enjoyable but not too stimulating. Don't lie awake in bed. When you lie awake in bed, your brain gets bored. The part of the brain that stays online most of the night is the part that scans our environment for threats. So our thoughts often become more active, and they tend to be more anxiety-driven. And we know that if people get up, they might be up longer that night, but they're less likely to do that in future nights, provided they follow the other rules of this. Second rule, or fourth rule, is don't worry, plan, or ruminate in bed. If your mind is active, get up and go do something distracting until you feel sleepy. Don't nap during the day unless you're sick and need the rest to recover, or if you have to take a brief nap to drive or operate machinery safely. But when we started, I said that sleep pressure builds up steadily throughout the day, and so if you take a nap, it bleeds off that sleep pressure, which then makes it more difficult for you to sleep at night. And insomniacs often get stuck in this vicious cycle where they sleep poorly at night, so they nap during the day, but that nap then makes them more likely to sleep poorly at night. And the final rule is go to bed only when sleepy, but not before your normal bedtime. So I noted that when you get out of bed during the middle of the night because your mind is active or you're awake for long periods of time, stay up until you feel sleepy. And then this last rule says go to bed when you're sleepy. But people often make the mistake of assuming that sleepy is synonymous with tired, fatigued, exhausted, and it's not. Tired, fatigued, and exhausted are energy states. It's that low motivation, that feeling unwell, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're sleepy. Sleepy is when you're starting to nod off. And so what happens is people who have sleep problems will often say, I went to bed because I was so tired and exhausted. And I'll ask them, but were you sleepy? And they'll say, no, I was wide awake and alert. So then you need to stay up until you feel sleepy.
Interesting points. Six points there. Those rules make really good sense as you explained it.
Right. Well, and the thing about sleep is it's logical and it follows rules. The truth is we don't teach people the logic of sleep or the rules of sleep, and some of those rules are counterintuitive. So if you have insomnia, you should spend less time in bed, but intuitively think we should spend more time in bed so we have more opportunity to catch sleep. So the rules do work, and they do follow the rules of sleeping. They just might not make sense to us in the moment.
Yeah. Nancy in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Nancy, hi.
Hi. I wanted to talk about women's health and menopause because hot flashes are a terrible interrupter of sleep, and they can lead to brain fog. And I've noticed that women tend to think that we just have to accept that, and we're all just going to walk around, you know, with a little bit of brain fog. And I experienced that myself, and I talked to my doctor and got on hormone replacement therapy, and the hot flashes went away, and there went my sleep interruption. And I have no more problems with that middle of the night insomnia.
That's wonderful to hear, Nancy. And the truth is, women struggle with sleep at different points throughout their lifespan. In general, women are 2 times more likely than men to have insomnia. But it also changes with their menstrual cycle. So even within a month, their sleep can fluctuate. They go through radical changes when they're pregnant. And when they get to that peri or postmenopausal state, their sleep tends to get even worse. One of the other things that happen is men are 4 times more likely than women to have sleep apnea until menopause, and then it's a 1-to-1 ratio. So there are things you can do environmentally. You can wear moisture-wicking clothes, cool the room, but exactly what you said is a good route to explore. So hormone replacement therapy does work, and for most women it can help. There are some risks involved in hormone replacement therapy, especially with certain types of cancer, but that is a discussion you should have with your doctor, and if it's appropriate, it's worth giving it a try, because for you, it sounds like it was the miracle you were looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. Nancy, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Allie in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Allie.
Hi. So I was calling because I'm wondering, when you have a newborn or a baby, how can we make sure that we are getting good sleep hygiene or getting enough sleep?
Yeah, and that's a challenge because newborns are polyphasic, which means they don't really have a rhythm to their sleep yet, so they're awake and asleep at different times, and it often conflicts with ours. We know that poor sleep post-delivery increases the risk of postpartum depression and other mental health disorders, and so it's really difficult, and I think this is one of those cases where if you have a partner, you should really have a talk with the partner about how to manage this. So when my wife and I had newborns, we would take turns at night. I would get up and change the diaper. When the baby was breastfeeding, I'd bring it to her, and then I'd put it back in the crib. And once the baby got to a bottle and wasn't breastfeeding, then we did alternate nights so that at least every other night the person was getting good sleep. It is a challenging period, and unfortunately in our society, the bulk of newborn care still falls on the women. And that's where if you have a partner or a friend or someone who can give you a break, it can make a world of difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. DJ in Madison, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
For the program. I wanted to talk about cat naps, since it has not been mentioned, and I know it has a lot to do with if you get too much, it interferes with your sleep, especially if you're a night owl like me. You get a little bit too much, and you're tugging on your eyelids at 2:30 in the morning.
Right. So, go ahead, Larry.
No. Go ahead, Dr. Blackburn.
So naps have always been confusing to people because the rule is if you have problems sleeping at night, you should not nap because that bleeds off the sleep pressure and makes the next night more difficult. If you sleep okay at night, but you're still tired during the day because you don't have the opportunity to get enough sleep, naps can be very beneficial. And in fact, cultures across the world have incorporated this into their practices. Mediterranean and Mexican cultures have the siesta. British take short naps called kips, and they caffeinate at tea time. The Japanese actually have nap pods built into their work headquarters. So what you call a cat nap, we call a power nap. And basically, it's 20 to 30 minutes that you sleep to bleed off sleep pressure so you can function well during the day and still not disrupt your sleep at night. Ideally, that power nap would take place at least 10 hours before your bedtime so that sleep pressure can build up again. But again, if you're operating heavy machinery, driving, or doing something that requires a lot of sustained attention, a cat nap can be very beneficial.
Yeah. DJ, thank you very much for calling. Bill in Cornucopia, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good afternoon. Great program. I find sleep fascinating. It's a fascinating component. And I remember doing a speech in college days where I presented the fact that we sleep one-third of our lives. And at that time, I was, 21 years old and thought, my gosh, I slept 7 years of my life already. And that to wrap my head around that just was a fascinating thing to me and really made me look at sleep in a different way. A couple suggestions I have. I love your sleep rules, and I love the concept of sleep pressure because I've never thought of it that way. A couple things that have worked for me, and I slept pretty good most of my adult life except for before hip surgery and getting hips replaced. I was in a lot of pain, and I had a lot of more compassion for people who have issues sleeping because, holy cow, to wake up in the morning after a night of pain and not sleeping well was not pleasant. Well, a few things I found that have been very, very helpful, no eating or drinking alcohol late into the night. And when I say no eating, I don't mean like a couple cookies at 8 o'clock. I'm talking about a heavy meal. And not drinking wine to 10 o'clock at night. Very, very important to me. Probably one of the most important is adequate exercise, especially being outdoors during the day as much as possible. To me, that gives the most sleep pressure, really makes that pressure go very high for me personally. Another thing is really avoiding, again, going to your stimulation control that you mentioned, absolutely or minimal screen time, anything electronic in the last couple hours before bed. And then finally, what I found to be extremely helpful is in that wind down period where you're maybe shutting your computer down and setting the thermostats and brushing your teeth is just very mindful, slow, deep, quiet breathing. And I find most nights I'm asleep between 5 and 15 minutes after I hit the bed if I've incorporated those things, as well as some of the other things you mentioned in your six rules of sleep too. But
yeah, those are all excellent suggestions, Bill. The one thing that's starting to be rethought about is the impact of screens on our sleep. So initially we thought light in itself was bad, and then we found that blue and green spectrum of lights were more harmful than other forms of light. And some of the research coming out now says that that might not be as big of a deal as we thought it was. The big thing is that people are often on their phones a lot and they sacrifice sleep so that they can stay on their screens. But the rest of those things about cutting down on alcohol, not eating a heavy meal before you go to bed, and even reducing caffeine during the day are all excellent suggestions. It sounds, Bill, like you're on the right track and you found some good skills.
Yeah, it sure does. Bill, thank you very much for calling. Some really good skills there. Karen in Madison. Your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you? I just wondered, I have REM sleep disorder. It was a long time ago, and I'm still taking Klonopin for it. I'm 70 now, and I just wondered, am I more at risk from having been diagnosed with REM sleep disorder to get like dementia or Parkinson's or something like that? Or is it more that I want to get off these pills so I don't get dementia?
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about REM sleep disorder. When we go into REM sleep, which is the stage where we dream, our body develops what's called muscle atonia, where essentially our brain disconnects itself from your muscles so that you don't act out your dreams. Some people develop a disorder where they do act out their dreams. It's much more common in men, and it tends to start after age 50. And the questions Karen were asking are exactly the concerns that we have, because within 10 to 12 years of developing REM behavior disorder, 90% of people go on to develop a neurodegenerative disorder like Parkinson's or Lewy body dementia. How long ago did you say you were diagnosed, Karen?
I'm 70 now, and I was probably in my 40s.
Okay.
So you might not be at high risk for that, because typically the changes happen. And again, it's not 100%. It's much higher in men than in women. Now, your concern about the clonazepam, we used to believe that medications in that class would cause an increased risk of dementia. And what's starting to be rethought now is that people with dementia are more likely to be on clonazepam. So we've been looking at it as this medication causes dementia, and now we're looking at they're correlated, but it's not causal. The big risk with medications like clonazepam are that it affects balance and it increases the risk of falls, which for someone in their 70s increases the risk for hip fractures and other injuries.
Karen?
You can also... Yeah. Oh, one other thing, Karen, is you can talk to your doctor, because there is some evidence out there that high doses of melatonin are as effective as clonazepam. And so that would be something to discuss with a sleep specialist. What I would tell you is make sure you don't go cold turkey off clonazepam. Make sure you follow your doctor's instructions, because suddenly stopping that can cause some problems.
Okay. Karen, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Rick Blackburn, our guest, Behavioral Health Sleep Medicine Director at Nystrom and Associates Counseling in New Brighton, Minnesota, a licensed psychologist. Great to have him with us today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking sleep today with our guest, Dr. Rick Blackburn of Nystrom and Associates Counseling in New Brighton, Minnesota, licensed psychologist and the director of Behavioral Health Sleep Medicine. Great to have him with us today. I want to go back to sleep for a minute, because our producer, Clara, had heard that having certain dreams indicate you're subconsciously stressed out. For example, if you're maybe dreaming about losing your teeth, you're stressed. Any truth to that? As a sleep medicine director, do you study your patients' dreams?
No. So back in the 1950s, when they discovered REM sleep, it pretty much threw out most of the psychoanalytic approach to dream interpretation. What we do know is that our dreams tend to be filled with content that have to do with our predominant emotion during the day. So like if you're going back to school and you have that back to school dream of not knowing where your classes are and it's final days and maybe you're not wearing clothing, it's a sign of anxiety. So in REM sleep, our body takes memories and it basically lessens the strength of the emotional tone to that memory. So it's like overnight therapy. Your mother was right. If something's upsetting, you sleep on it, you'll probably feel better in the morning. So yes, if you're having anxiety-provoking dreams, it's probably because you're feeling more anxious, but not necessarily so.
Angela in Appleton will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Angela.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. What I'm calling about is to just talk about my personal experience with how my cats can disrupt my sleep during the night, and that what I learned I had to do was to close the bedroom door and put boxes and other things in front of it to prevent them from knocking on the door and waking me up, but mainly just to prevent them from sleeping with me. Many years ago, when I was feeling horrible and I had a lot of pain and stuff, and I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, which I didn't want to believe I had, and at that point, I ended up not allowing my cats to sleep with me, and all my symptoms went away, and I was feeling better again. I was sleeping through the night. So now I realize I have to start doing the same with my new cats, and just wanted to pass that along for other people who might have problems with animals disrupting their sleep.
Yeah. Angela, yeah. Go ahead, Rick.
And it's not just animals. I mean, it can also be bed partners. So a few years ago, they published a statistic that 43% of partners don't sleep in the same bed because one sleep disrupts the other's sleep. And they called it a sleep divorce, and it's perfectly normal, and it doesn't affect the stability or the strength of the relationship. But I think what Angela is suggesting is that there are things within your environment that can disrupt your sleep. For her, it was cats. And if it's something that's happening regularly, you need to work to find a solution for that.
Makes a very good sense. A listener called, couldn't stay with us, but we've kind of addressed this a little bit. But what are your comments about reading in bed? And I'll go along with that listener. I have, in the course of a year, I'll read at least 50 books for this radio show. And I've often sat in bed and read myself. And I can usually fall asleep after reading a chapter or two. But what are your comments on reading in bed?
So sleep is unique, right? If you don't have insomnia, reading in bed might not be a bad thing. When people come in for treatment for, like, insomnia, we apply the rules rigidly and we take away everything that can disrupt sleep. And then after their sleep improves, then we can experiment with adding things back in bed. But people are different. I had a patient that we took away her reading in bed and suddenly it was taking her an hour or longer to fall asleep. And she said, you know, if I could just read in bed, I'd fall asleep within 5 minutes. So I said, let's test it and see what the data shows. And she was right. So these rules are applied to everyone. But just like everything, there are unique exceptions in every person. So if you're having problems sleeping at night, getting rid of activities in bed is a good idea. If not, it might be okay.
All right. V from Kenosha emailed us, 36-year-old male takes 50 milligrams of trazodone each night for the last 6 months and has no issue falling asleep within 30 minutes, usually has only a little grogginess in the morning. V typically goes to sleep around 9 p.m. and wakes at 5, usually becomes very tired around 4 p.m. Is this a result of the trazodone or the drug? Is this a drug that V can use long-term with little issues down the road, or something V should try to eventually work out of sleep's routine?
So trazodone is an old sedating antidepressant, and it's been around for a long, long time. It's not used for depression anymore because the doses that were needed for it to have an antidepressant effect, people couldn't stay awake. So it's now one of the most commonly prescribed sleep medications, and it's what doctors call a dirty medication because it's not very selective in what receptor sites in the brain it attaches to. It has a long half-life, so there's often that morning kind of hangover effect. But I think what V is talking about is when we talked about that alerting signal that helps us stay awake during the day, for people typically between noon and about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that signal weakens a little bit. So it's normal for us to get a little bit sleepy in the afternoon. And if you elevate your body temperature by getting a little exercise or light, it can minimize that. But 50 milligrams of trazodone is not likely causing his sedation at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
What do you know about the time change and how it affects the way we sleep? And I just personally, I can tell you, it takes me weeks to get over this stupid fall back. I'm not a problem. It's not a problem in the spring for a day, only a day or two. But in the evening, in the fall, it is a problem.
Yeah. So, I mean, the sleep world has been trying to get rid of daylight savings time for years, and it comes up in Congress almost every session and then doesn't happen. But it does disrupt. So we know that when we spring ahead in the spring, that the day after that, there's the greatest number of car accidents and heart attacks and strokes, and it's because of the effect it has on our body. Now, some people like the fall, unlike Larry, because their body clocks tend to be slower and they tend to be night owls, so it more fits in with their circadian rhythm. For those of us who are early birds, we like the one in the spring because now we can go to bed at what seems to be a more reasonable time and we wake up when we're normally waking up. But what we do know is that it has a huge effect. It does take time to adjust to it. And ideally, we would get rid of it. But that hasn't happened yet. But my hope is that it will soon.
Oh, yeah, me too. It just drives me crazy how long it takes me to get over this. A judge called, couldn't stay with us, wondering if there's any news or research about the Inspire sleep system. It's a surgical implant. It treats obstructive sleep apnea by stimulating the throat muscles to keep the airway open while sleeping. Mayo Clinic, yes. I think, has done some work on it.
Yep. So Inspire is actually a Minnesota company. And it is basically they insert a pacemaker-like device in your right upper chest. There's a wire that goes down to your diaphragm or your breathing muscle, and then another wire goes up and attaches to the hypoglossal muscle, which is the one that controls your tongue. When the sensor on your diaphragm senses that you're struggling to breathe, it applies an electrical current that makes your tongue go forward a little bit so it opens up your airway. It's sort of akin to doing the jaw thrust in CPR. It is very effective. You do have to jump through some hoops. Most insurances require that you fail on CPAP or BiPAP before. And then you go in and they'll put you out with propofol, like when you go in for a surgical procedure, and they want to make sure that the apnea is caused by the tongue going back into the throat. If it is, then you can get it. I've only had two patients who have had it, and they both love it. Because basically they turn it on when they get into bed with a magnet, they turn it off in the morning, and they don't have to wear a CPAP or a machine.
Yeah, those the machines are, I had one for a while myself, but then I lost about 30 pounds and it went away. I tested again and it was, I passed. I didn't have it anymore. But they are very, to me, I had an awful time trying to adjust to those, and it inspired me to lose the weight.
Yeah. And, you know, I have a CPAP too, and I love it. I don't even take a nap without it, but it does take adjustment getting to it. So like Larry, you said that we're based out of New Brighton. We're actually in 5 states with over 60 clinics, and we just opened up 9 in Wisconsin. So if you're having problems with sleep or you're having problems getting used to CPAP, we can help you get there.
I tell you what, a lot of people might be looking you up there, Rick. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Boy, it flew by, and we didn't get to everybody, but that's usually the way it is on the show. Thank you again, and I hope we can do this again. Look forward to another visit with you.
I would love to. Thank you for the invite today. I enjoyed it.
Dr. Rick Blackburn, a behavioral Health Sleep Medicine Director at Nystrom & Associates Counseling in New Brighton, Minnesota, a licensed psychologist. Great to have him with us. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. This and all our shows are a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Really appreciate your time spent listening with us, and I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'll tell you what, my guest and I were both bobbing our heads to that tune, The Syncopated Clock. Leroy Anderson was the composer of it, but I thought it was good music to get us going here as we talk about circadian rhythms, and we're talking about the book. It's titled The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms, a fascinating book. I really had a lot of fun reading it. And our guest to tell us more about the importance of circadian rhythms, Lynn Peoples. Lynn is a science journalist from Seattle. She was an MIT Knight Science Journalist Fellow, holds master's degrees in biostatistics from the Harvard School of Public Health, and in science journalism from New York University. And as we talk with her, I want to hear from you. Let us know what you notice about your body and how it responds to changes in the clock, maybe around daylight savings time one way or the other. Or maybe you have trouble getting to sleep at night, wondering how screens or other light sources might be affecting your bedtime routine. Lynn Peoples, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry. Happy to be here.
How many miles? Did you keep track of how many miles you put on in your exploration?
Oh, I totally should have. I mean, I can tell you a lot of jet lag was suffered over the course of researching the book.
I mean, you were in England, you were in New York, you were in, of course, Seattle, you were in, was it Arkansas?
Arkansas, Alaska, yep, Denmark, yeah, it got around.
Certainly had to affect your circadian rhythm.
For sure.
But a lot of people usually think about it in terms of sleep. But what other daily functions do our circadian rhythms control?
Yeah, the real question is, what don't they control? It was really eye-opening to me as I dove into this subject that circadian rhythms really drive most every function of our body. Because the truth is, just about every cell of our body has a clock, right? And so all our organs, everything are from our metabolism to our defenses against invading pathogens to our sleep cycles, everything is dictated by the clock. And so we've got these clocks. They're all trying to coordinate with each other to anticipate the right time of day to do things. And they're also trying to coordinate with the sun, because these clocks don't tick at exactly 24 hours a day. That's where the circa and circadian comes from. It's about a day that these clocks tick on. And so, but to time things right for our body to live on this planet that has a 24-hour day, we need to keep everything in sync and keep in sync with the light and dark cycles that of this planet we live on. So that's where it's really driving and coordinating to make sure our body is efficient and doing those right things at the right times of day.
And you know what was really interesting to me as well is that all animals, insects, plants all operate that way, right?
Yes, just about all of life that scientists have investigated so far evolved to have these clocks. So obviously they're important. They are useful to survival. And as humans, we evolved with them as well.
What made you start thinking about your own inner clock?
Yeah, you know, it. I really think subconsciously it had been, well, obviously it's driving things for all of us. But as somebody who grew up in Seattle, where we're at a really high latitude, I didn't quite realize it, but, you know, we're above you. We're above a lot of, like, big Canadian cities even. And at this latitude, the days, you know, really fluctuate throughout the year. Really long days, really short days. And like most places still today, in high school, we started at before 7:30 a.m. So, you know, for months of the year, I was going to school basically in the dark, leaving after sports practice in the dark. And I noticed, you know, this very obvious change in kind of my mood and my my energy and throughout the course of the year, you know, summers versus winters, really different. And so, and I think, you know, I've always had sleep problems myself, struggled a lot with that growing up and continued as an adult. So these things were kind of going on in the background, but I didn't really think that much of it until I had moved back to Seattle after stints in Minnesota, which was actually really nice because the winters can be bright, like in Wisconsin with the sun reflecting off the snow. But I'd moved back to Seattle and I had visited this locker room of the Seattle Mariners, my hometown baseball team, and they had installed these new lights that you could adjust in intensity and color in the locker room. And the idea was to try to help the players' circadian rhythms, to energize them before games, to relax them after so they could sleep. And as this was being described to me, I remember thinking, whoa, you know, like, okay, this is what's driving them to do this because, you know, these players are not getting maybe adequate light and dark. And, you know, if it's really going to energize them before the game, what could that do for me? Like, should I be thinking about this? Could this explain my, you know, my lifelong struggles?
And so is that, that's probably why you decided to write this book.
Yes, exactly. That led me to write a one feature story on circadian lighting, which opened my eyes to so many other aspects of how circadian rhythms influence our well-being and our health. So I went down the circadian medicine rabbit hole next, and then it was just, I was all in.
Oh, man. Well, one part of the book that I found really interesting was when you spent 10 days in an underground bunker missile silo. You got to tell that story in the first place. How did you wind up there and what was it, you know, so forth?
Yeah, so I was motivated as part of the book to try to experience for myself what happened. Well, A, what do my inner clocks really, like, what pace do they tick at? Because we're all our clocks are ticking a little differently. And that explains why there's some of us that are early birds and some are night owls and everything in between. So I wanted to get a sense of how do my clocks tick naturally without any cues? And then how, you know, what happens when they fall out of sync? So really, I wanted to put myself in a space void of any input as to the 24-hour Earth day. So that's any daylight or anything else that's synced to that, right? So I cut myself off from other humans, like any media, and really any light, because light messes with our rhythms, as we might get to. So I was just searching far and wide. And on Airbnb, I found that this man had purchased a nuclear missile silo from the government. This had been used in the Cold War and sealed up for decades. But he popped it open and then spent many years souping it up into this luxurious Airbnb. And so I moved in for 10 days and we dimmed all the lights and only used red light, which is the color least likely to influence your circadian rhythms. So I lived under dim red light, decked out in a bunch of devices measuring everything from my heart rate to my temperature to my blood glucose levels. Didn't look at any clocks. And just try to live for 10 days and see what happened.
And it was, I mean, you had to tape over. Of course, there were all kinds of clocks and everything in this place that you had to.
Yep. It's amazing how many clocks are in our world. I didn't realize it until I was trying to avoid them, and they're everywhere.
And you kind of were synced in with some other folks, researchers, as part of this.
Yes. Yeah. Right, afterwards, yeah. So I collected all this data, and then some scientists helped me analyze that data and look at what happened to these various rhythms in my body. And yeah, sure enough, you know, a few days in, they started falling out of sync with each other. and then falling out of sync with the 24-hour day. So my rhythms just drifted, and at one point I was completely flipped. I was living my days when the people above ground were sleeping.
And isn't that how animals, you know, wild animals, they're more active at night?
Some, yeah, there are some nocturnal species. Yes, right. There's a lot of nocturnal species that are most active at night. And then there's crepuscular, you know, active at sunrise, sunset. We, you know, if you kind of step back and think about the evolution of this planet, different species were finding different niches, right? So, you know, some were going to be taking advantage of the daylight part of the Earth, you know, day-night, light-dark cycles. And then the other species were, you know, filling in at night. And so their physiology evolved to take advantage of those, you know, what circumstances they would be in at during those particular hours. And the clocks helped them out.
Our guest today, Lynn Peoples, her book is titled The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. A fascinating book. Let's go to Glenn in Big Rapids, Michigan. Hi, Glenn. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call and for the show. I am wondering if your guest has looked at the proximity to the extreme edges of time zones and how that affects those populations. I've noticed that, you know, places that like New York is on the extreme eastern edge of the eastern time zone. I live on what would be the extreme western edge. And then it changes how the lengths of days sync up with the clock.
That is a really good question. And scientists have, and economists actually, have looked at some data to try to kind of tease out some of the differences. And in fact, I mean, as you're alluding to, the eastern side of a time zone, people there are being exposed to an earlier sunrise than on the western side, according to the, you know, the clock on the wall. Mm-hmm. And scientists have found that on the eastern edge of the time zone, people are, in fact, you know, on the whole, healthier. If you look at the data going from east to west within a time zone, cancer rates slightly increase. And also salaries start to decrease and longevity starts to decrease as you go from where the sun rises earlier to when the where the sun rises later. Because our clocks really are counting on that morning light to keep calibrated and in sync. And if we're missing that, you know, that early morning light and that light's getting pushed later, as it does under daylight saving time, for example, then there's some evidence that, you know, health, there are health consequences of that.
Ah, interesting. Glenn, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Lynn Peoples. She is the author of the book, The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. And just a reminder, if you missed part of our show or just want to hear it again, you can always go to our archive at WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings of all of our broadcasts going back a long, long way. Christina in Glenwood City has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. You mentioned that you had sleep challenges. Has this been resolved as a result of your research? And what advice do you have for those who do have challenges and follow good sleep hygiene? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. So it's an ongoing challenge for me, I will admit, but I have found some tools that definitely help. And I really have kind of broken it down to three really kind of core rules that I try my best to incorporate into my day-to-day to improve my sleep. And that is really finding contrast in my days, creating that contrast. So really trying to get my days bright, especially morning light, getting out for, you know, 20 minutes in the morning to walk to coffee if possible, or sitting on my balcony. I am fortunate to have a big window by my desk. So just trying to get as much light during the day as possible, and then really cutting the lights at night. Just trying to turn off, especially every overhead light, lights that have particularly blue wavelengths of light, you really want to try to cut out. And I use these electric candles around my apartment to just kind of create a nice warm glow. So it's really, yeah, the light and dark contrast. And then constricting my meal times as much as possible throughout the day to try to limit, because when we evolved really to eat during daylight hours. And so the science is really pointing to, in particular, the importance of cutting off any incoming calories a few hours before bed. And I find when I do that, I really do sleep a lot better. Just like 3 hours before bed, if I can not take in any, you know, sips of wine or any bites of, you know, chips or anything like that. Just sometimes hard to do to have a social life. And then finally, consistency. So if I can try to, you know, get up and go to bed at a similar time every night, it's so much easier to fall asleep and wake up at, you know, those times. So when I'm able to incorporate those three rules, I do find that my sleep problems are much, much resolved. But it's, you know, it's hard on our, in society today, and you know, balance the social life and balance all these things.
We have light a lot. I mean, yes. Our society, I mean, we're under light many more hours than, say, an animal in the wild might be.
Right, unless they're exposed to light pollution. So we're actually, our light's invading their environments as well. But it is totally true. I mean, right, walk outside, especially the new LED streetlights are very bright. You know, walk into a store and those grocery store lights are just really, you know, glaring. And then, you know, I'm, you know, more cognizant now, obviously, after doing all this research. But, you know, I walk into my dad's house or a friend's home, and now I just, those overhead lights seem so bright to me. But that's, yeah, it's what we, most of us are used to. So we have lights, we're exposed to artificial light many more hours of the day than if we were, say, camping.
Marty in Whitewater, your turn. Hi, Marty.
Good morning, good afternoon, rather. Thank you for taking my call. Circadian rhythms, is there any correlation between that and seasonal affective disorder? And I'll listen off air. Thank you.
All right, thank you for calling.
Yeah, good question. Absolutely. There is a lot of research that has looked into the role of circadian rhythms and your being predisposed to seasonal affective disorder. So the rates of SAD are higher at higher latitudes, perhaps not surprising when you think about, you know, people I talk to in Alaska where the days get really, really short in the winter and really long in the summer. And those throw the circadian, you know, really confused circadian rhythms. So there's ample evidence, and this is also pointing to potential tools that people can use if they're prone to the effects in the wintertime. And that's, you know, trying to make use of these sun lamps or other bright light that can, as closely as possible, mimic the sun. If you expose yourself to that in the morning for a particular amount of time, you know, usually they come with these lights will come with instructions, then that can kind of make up for the fact that it might still be dark outside and help reset your inner clocks as they were, you know, evolved really to anticipate that light in the morning. Because it's, you know, it wasn't that long ago that we migrated north and south. So there's certain populations with the genetics that might help them a little more at those extreme latitudes. And there's others of us that perhaps aren't quite ready for that. And so we might need to sort of trick our clocks in a way to give them the light in the dark, a little closer to the 12 hours a day that where we initially evolved at the equator.
So in the morning, the alarm clock for me goes off, my phone goes off at 5:40. And then I get up and then I go a couple, 3 miles through the neighborhood. I usually don't want to get up, be honest. But then once I get up, I'm fine. And it's more fun in the summer, although this morning when I was out, you know, we had a full moon and Mars was just to kind of lower right of the moon. And so, and I was running along the lake and there were lights across the lake that were pretty attractive. But I'm sure I'm going against my own probably circadian rhythm, because if we need a an alarm clock, we're probably, as you well point out in your book, we're probably not in our rhythm. I have to do it because, well, I like to do it, but also because, you know, there's a time constraint. I have to do my time outdoors, come back, take a shower, and then go to work.
Right. And do you do that same, like, routine 7 days a week? Do you get up at the same time when you're not working?
Probably not. On the average, it might be more like six.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that the key test, if you're living according to your inner clocks, is, as you suggested, you know, are you using an alarm clock? If you're waking up to your alarm clock, that's not when your body wants to wake up. So, but that's the case for most of us. Most of us have to, you know, abide by some forced schedule on our lives. And the only way to really tell what your inner clocks really want to do naturally is to, shut off the alarm clock and maybe, well, I mean, basically to go on vacation. It takes a few days, but if you can let yourself just go and live according to what your body's telling you to do, you know, when to fall asleep, when to wake up, and then when during the day do you have, you know, the energy to go for a run, like you said, or to do various things. All these inclinations, all these particular, you know, strengths throughout the day will ebb and flow.
Yeah, and I think you're right, because I was on vacation for a week. Well, it's, you know, with the weekend days, it was 9 days. And I turned my clock off. And I did wake up early, but not quite as early as 5:40 every morning. And then I fell into what you call the Netflix effect, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Right. So, I mean, so our clocks are somewhat malleable. So, you know, we have this genetic predisposition based on the way our clocks tick to rise and, you know, sleep at certain times of day, et cetera. But those, because they're, you know, only about 24 hours and respond to light and dark and these various inputs, we can kind of train them. So the fact that you still wake up, you know, reasonably early, you have kind of, you know, indeed trained your clock. So you're kind of, you've shifted a little bit. And then, yeah, this Netflix effect can happen. So because of the power of these inputs, if you, say, stay up late, expose yourself to artificial light, watch a Netflix show, stimulating the brain into a later hour, then, you know, wake up a little later, miss the morning light, it can essentially snowball. So then the next night, maybe you're up even later and, you know, under artificial light. And this can just, stack up and really put you out of sync.
Yeah, it can indeed. Craig had emailed back to Alaska for a minute, wondering if you went during extreme darkness or extreme sunlight, and you were there for extreme sunlight.
Yeah, I was
talking about that experience. It sounded great in a lot of ways.
It certainly was a nicer experience than being in a bunker without any light. I did a long weekend camping under the midnight sun. So the sun would set where I was in Denali National Park at this particular time, but it never got dark. So it's, you know, barely dipped below the horizon and popped kind of right back up. And I was there with a bunch of folks that lived in Anchorage in the surrounding area. So this was their reality, you know, they lived there and went through the seasons. And they were telling me about how they basically felt kind of this manic, you know, manic, depressive or bipolar moods throughout the year. And in the summer, like during our trip, it was, you know, it's more that manic. It's just like you got to soak up every minute of sun while you got it. And you're energized. And I felt that my sleep was horrible. It's really hard to sleep in a tent when doesn't get dark. But that sun has this energizing effect. So light does more to us than just affect our rhythms. You know, it has, as we probably know intuitively, it's energizing, directly energizing, and has these other impacts that actually scientists are still exploring, which is fascinating. But that kind of compensated a little bit for my lack of sleep. So it was a lot of fun. It's definitely, I came back and just needed to sleep for a long time. But yeah, very different than being underground for 10 days, for sure.
One little aside that you had in the book relating to that was the sun, the change from light to dark and dark to light is very fast in Alaska.
Yes, right. Those transition weeks, right, where in the spring, where in the days are lengthening, and in the fall, and the days are shortening. I spoke with a sleep doctor in Fairbanks on my way to Denali. And he was talking about those were the periods of time where he actually saw the most patients with sleep troubles and other, depression and various disorders that could be related to circadian rhythms. And indeed, I mean, we didn't evolve at these high latitudes. And so that quick change is really confusing our clocks, because our clocks, so they don't just serve as a daily clock, but they also serve as calendars. So as those days shrink, as we have, you know, varying inputs of light throughout the day, as those timings shift, that's telling our body that, oh, you know, spring is approaching or summer is approaching. And you could think how important this would be for a lot of species for when they're mating, when they might be migrating. So evolutionarily, yeah, these clocks serve a lot of purposes. And one is that calendar, and humans, you know, there's some effects here still, and it's very confusing when that's happening really, really rapidly.
Yeah.
And
you noted that violence, or even domestic violence,
yes,
jumps in Alaska during those couple of times when the changes occur.
Yes, that is what the sleep doctor had found. Yep.
Mert emailed, what impact does not having a window in your office have on your circadian rhythm? And you do spend a fair amount of time in a chapter or two on offices and working. Somebody else, Todd, had emailed and wondering, what about workers on rotating schedules is another one we can take up. But what impact does not having a window in your office first have on your circadian rhythm?
Yeah, not having a window just makes it really tough for the body to know that it's daytime. I mean, that, you know, goes back to the importance of having that contrast, that really light day and that dark night. So again, I'm fortunate I have a window here. A lot of people are not. And you can think about the inequities that come up here too, because there's probably certain segments of the population that are most likely do not have access to that window corner office, right? You know, they might be working in a basement or a back of the house space or a warehouse. And so without that access to that bright blue rich light that the sun gives, the body is struggling to know that it's daytime and doing, you know, anticipating the activities that it needs to do during the daytime. Now, as we understand the importance of this, scientists are developing better artificial lights that are closer mimics of the sun that could be installed in some of these offices that can help.
And as long as we're on windows for a minute, you had a really interesting chapter, I thought, on England. You tell a little history of England, and there was a tax on windows.
Right. Yeah. Some centuries ago, they did use a tax on windows as a proxy for income tax, because you could think about, you know, a larger home, a richer family would have more windows, right? But people tried to get around this by bricking up their windows. And as I learned, you know, landlords would do this. So again, poor families, you know, may lose their windows as they were trying to evade taxes. So there was a period of time in which daylight was cut off to a large extent in a lot of these homes, just to cut down on taxes. And finally, enough people were kind of adamant about the importance of both light and air, because obviously if you cut off a window, you're not getting a lot of fresh air coming in, and they ultimately lifted the tax. But I got to see firsthand. I walked around London and saw some of these relics, some old bricked up windows. They're still out there.
And the first alarm clock was actually a person.
Yes, before we had our alarm clocks on our nightstands or our phones, there were human alarm clocks. So I learned about what were called knocker uppers. Yes, and they would walk the streets with a pipe in which they blew dried peas at people's bedroom windows to wake them up in the morning. So you think this is about the time that, you know, factories started employing workers, and, you know, they'd start at really early hours, and yeah, how are they going to wake up to get to work on time? So they would hire somebody to wake them, to knock them up. And the little, you know, dried peas would rattle and wake them up. And then in some places, I mean, it was amusing. And in Italy, they had what were called hooters that would blow these really loud, shrieky whistles to wake people up.
So you had knocker-uppers and hooters. And the hooters got into trouble because the neighbors, who might not be happy to get up at that time,
they would wake them up too. Or, you know, if, you know, for the hooter themselves, they didn't want that to happen because they wanted all the money they could get. They want to, you know, they don't want to just blow one whistle to wake everybody up. They want to, you know, get paid for each customer. So
also a problem. You were getting at a little bit, and you spent some time on this, on the class problems that can be associated with buildings and structures. You mentioned Japan. There's a right to sunshine law that governs the height and shape of buildings. But I know you zeroed in on New York, but other large cities have similar. Just describe that a little bit.
Yeah, this really kind of stood out to me as I was doing my travels. I mean, there's really, well, I mean, step back. You think about food deserts, right? A lot of us have heard of that. There's particular neighborhoods where it's hard to get access to healthy food. And there also appears to be, you know, daylight deserts. And you can also think of darkness deserts, because again, we need daylight during the day, darkness at night. And, you know, poor families, certain segments of the population are more apt to be living in, say, basement apartments, you know, in the shadows of, especially in urban areas, you know, living in the shadows during the day, working in spaces, again, without access to daylight, without a window. And then at night, these are the same people that might be more prone to artificial light, this light pollution that's, you know, creeping into their bedrooms. So maybe they're living in a public housing project, which I walked through a few in both New York and London, where they have these massively bright LED, you know, lights up around, including, like, there's police floodlights in some areas, you know, to increase safety, right? That was the motivation for these, because there might be higher crime rates. And indeed, you know, there's people also probably lack blackout curtains to block out that light. And so they may not realize it, but this is, you know, impacting their sleep, and, you know, just another factor that's perpetuating the inequities.
Even in Central Park, I think, along the edge of Central Park, you mentioned the high rise.
Yeah, these towers going up and casting shadows into public spaces. And yeah, there's talk about for, you know, little public parks or schoolyards where these big buildings are casting shadows. So kids are, you know, maybe not getting daylight while they're outdoors. Yeah.
Amazing stuff. You bring in so many different aspects of all this in your book. It's really a pleasure to read and to learn about. Lynn Peoples, our guest, her book is The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Lynn Peoples about her book, the main title, The Inner Clock. It's great to have her with us. Questions as we talk about circadian rhythms, what about yours? Doug in Barnes, Wisconsin has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Doug.
Hello. I was wondering if your guest would care to comment on changing daylight savings time. People seem to get rather wound up about it twice a year. And yet, I guess an observation that I would make is that while they want to maybe do away with daylight savings time, at the same time, people seem to have no qualms at all about traveling across time zones, either for work or for vacations, perhaps even just to spend a weekend. So in my mind, I'm wondering if we can survive that, if it really makes it that much difference, whether we would revert back. Other than, I think, for most people, it's the convenience of not having to change their clocks.
All right. Doug, thanks for calling. What do you think, Lynn? You spend a fair amount of time on that in your book.
Right. It's definitely something, you're right, that people have kind of gotten wound up about, winding our clocks forward and back, I guess. So the science really points to, if we want to lock the clock one way or another, I think the popular opinion is leaning still slightly towards going permanent daylight saving time. The science suggests that standard time is far healthier for our rhythms and everything they dictate for our bodies. And that's because taking that hour of morning light and putting it at the end of the day, which is what daylight saving time does, is kind of doing the opposite of what our rhythms want, right? We want that morning light and we want that nighttime darkness. And to your point, I mean, so I guess there's two issues with daylight saving time, and there's that acute effect of that hour loss or that hour shift, you know, twice a year. And sure, there's slight increases scientists have found in like car accidents and heart attacks immediately after that change, particularly in the spring forward, that day, you know, that week after we spring forward. But, you know, it is somewhat a slight change. And you're right. I mean, people do accumulate more jet lag than even just that hour as we travel. But really the big issue at stake here, I think, is that long-term thinking about that hour shift. And now our bodies are kind of, you know, an hour out of alignment from the day-night cycle of on our planet. So that's where scientists are really kind of keyed in on. And that's why they're like really cautioning against trying to go on permanent daylight saving time. And I know personally in Seattle, if we were on daylight saving time in the winter, the sun wouldn't rise until like 9 o'clock for some portion of the winter. And when you think about kids going to school, you know, at 7 o'clock, you know, and it's, there's a lot of ripple effects that we should be thinking about.
And there have been some schools, by the way, that, as you write about in the book, that have changed their times.
Yes, right. Minnesota, I believe, was kind of one of the leaders. Some districts there shifted. So middle and high school, this is what we're really thinking about. So in general, when you hit adolescence, your circadian rhythms drift a little later. So this is a good part of why teens have trouble getting up early and going to bed early. And that's because of their biology as well as some societal factors. But if you were forcing in general, or, you know, at least in previous decades, we've been forcing these adolescents to get up even earlier for middle and high school than they were in elementary school. But yeah, some districts now are flipping that. So they're having elementary schools start earlier and middle and high schools start later, which is more in line with biology.
And it seems to, and there were some results that were actually the students themselves were doing better.
Yeah, some studies have followed up, looked at before and after these time changes, including in Seattle. Seattle Public Schools made a change just about a decade ago almost now. And indeed, they found, you know, kids are sleeping more, test scores are improving. So, yeah, there's evidence now that this is definitely beneficial. And if you think about this, I mean, sleep is really important for all of us, really important as you're still growing. And truncating sleep, if you're forcing a kid to get up too early, you're particularly cutting off some of their REM sleep, which happens at the end of the sleep cycle. And that is critically important to like solidifying memories and to, you know, I guess in a way, you know, controlling their behavior, because, you know, you want that brain functioning well in adolescence in particular, when these kids might be more vulnerable to certain things.
Doug, thank you for your question. Todd emailed, how can, and this goes back to something I started to ask you about earlier and mm-hmm. then we didn't follow up on, how can workers on rotating schedules adapt their circadian rhythms to minimize fatigue and improve overall health?
Yeah, that is a really big challenge. Yeah, good question. So there are various, you know, types of shift work. You got your night shifters, you got your, and these rotating shift workers are probably at the, you know, face the greatest challenges. So the one idea that the scientist brought up to me, who's really, you know, focused in on this, is because on average, our circadian rhythms are a little longer than 24 hours. If you are on a rotating schedule, I mean, hopefully your employer or whoever's setting the schedule is, if they're doing rotating shifts, you know, shifting your shift a little later each day. Because if your rhythms are a little longer, that means it's going to be a little easier, you know, to stay up a little later, stay up a little later. And then if you're, you know, flipping back and forth, the idea is to try to minimize that whiplash you're giving to your body. So if you're on a, you know, a day shift one day and then on a night shift another day, try to, you know, shift or try to move your sleep times and your wake up times a little closer to each other. So they're not quite so extreme. So maybe that does mean sleeping in on the weekends, right? If you're going to be doing a night shift, so you're just the most you can minimize that whiplash, the better. But on the whole, it's tough. Where, you know, consistency is really important for our circadian rhythms and all they run in our body. So, but there are things you could do.
there was another piece that I found really interesting. Well, I found all of it interesting, but you get into a bit about athletes. And, you know, now in this day and age where we're traveling across the country here, the Big Ten is now from one coast to the other coast as an example. And what is the impact of that for a team like the, well, let's say Rutgers, which is way over on the East Coast, and then they've got to go play UCLA or Oregon or Washington on the other coast, and, of course, vice versa.
Right. Yeah. I find this really interesting and really.
There was a guy who really got into that, and you talk about sort of he really got into the numbers on that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, so, you know, I grew up, obviously, I've mentioned the Mariners. I grew up a Seattle sports fan, and I was talking to this guy in Portland who also is a fan of Seattle sports as well as Portland sports. And he dove into data that was looking at the NBA. During COVID, when they went into a bubble in Disney World to play for the playoffs. So that essentially removed all these excess factors of time zones and jet lag, right? And he looked to see how did those players perform relative to each other and then relative to before the pandemic. And sure enough, you know, the bubble really leveled the playing field because, as he's found and some other scientists I've talked to, our bodies, again, everything's on a rhythm, and on average, our athletic performance peaks in the late afternoon or early evening. So if you have a team from the East Coast flying to the West Coast for a competition, let's say it's NFL football and the kickoff is at 1 p.m., right? So maybe you have, the New York Giants or something are flying into Seattle. At 1 p.m. in Seattle, their inner clocks are still ticking at about 4 p.m., right? Because they're East Coast time. That is about the start of, on average, peak athletic performance. Whereas the Seattle team is kind of on their midday slump. And so there's an uneven playing field there you could think about. So we have these college athletic conferences forcing these players to travel across time zones. So A, you've got more of a factor of jet lag, more hours, you know, away from school. And then plus perhaps, you know, less equity in circadian clocks and circadian performance, which is not something that was probably considered when these decisions were made.
Well, it is interesting. I thought back to a long time back to 1993 when the Badgers football team was playing a game in Japan against Michigan State. And it was a year, and it was kind of a bowl game. The Badgers actually also played in the Rose Bowl that year or that season. But Barry Alvarez, who was the coach, talked to a sleep specialist professor here at the university, and he had time because they knew it was coming. And I forget how it actually worked, but the guy had suggested that the players fall asleep a half hour earlier each night for I forget how many nights. But anyway, and it turned out that both teams were flying on the same plane to Japan. And Barry Alvarez said he walked through the plane at one point, and all the Michigan State players were asleep, and all the Badger players were awake. And he said he knew right then that the Badgers were gonna win the game.
And they won.
All right.
Yes. Oh, he was ahead of his time. And yes, there are now chrono coaches out there helping teams to do various things just like that. Yeah, just ahead of travel, which we can all take advantage of if we're like facing, you know, potential jet lag on vacation. And then using light, you know, strategically timed bright blue light, and then blue light blocking glasses at other times to help kind of more rapidly change your rhythms to line up with your destination time zone. So a lot of tools.
Yeah. Didn't you give a lamp to a friend who was going on a submarine or something?
It was a Coast Guard icebreaker that was headed to the Arctic. Yeah. So basically the same thing, because that, you know, at some point as they're headed north, well, there was no more light. The sun set and it didn't come back up. So I was hoping that sun lamp would kind of help him again trick his clocks into creating a day. And you know, anecdotally, N of one, but he found indeed that it helped. It helped his sleep, it helped his mood, it's helped his productivity. And I mean, the science does support this notion.
I thought it was funny too, because there were a couple of other lamps that had been given to other crew members as jokes, but it turned out they wound up using them anyway. Is there, you do talk about a link between circadian rhythms and Alzheimer's.
Yes. Among other chronic diseases, scientists are honing in on links. And it's looking, as far as dementia, Alzheimer's, cognitive decline, it's looking like it probably a two-way street where the damaged part of the brain in Alzheimer's is actually, you know, touching or basically part of what is helping to drive circadian rhythms. So A. And then B, there's evidence to suggest that as our circadian rhythms weaken as we age, that could be, and if, you know, if you have more disruption, that could be driving a more rapid pace at which you have, you know, the beta amyloid plaques, you know, building up in the brain. So there's a lot more research underway right now to really sort that out. We don't totally understand, but it looks like this two-way street, which is also pointing to maybe some new potential preventative strategies or ways to minimize some of the effects of Alzheimer's.
Yeah. So here we are getting out of time. What do you hope people take away with them after reading your book, The Inner Clock? I mean, it was really entertaining to begin with, but what do you hope people take away?
Yeah, I mean, I hope it's kind of an eye-opener to these kind of subtle effects that are happening inside of you, but having these profound effects on how your day-to-days are going, and then your long-term health and productivity. So I think there's, you know, things individuals can do, you know, again, you know, that contrast, that constricting meal times, and that consistency, kind of the three C's. So as individuals, we can do that to help our rhythms. And then broadly, thinking about as a society, what are some relatively low-hanging fruit that we can ideas that we can implement to help everyone. And, you know, thinking about the equity concerns, thinking about daylight saving time, school start times, how we draw time zones, like all these things could potentially affect, you know, population-wide health.
Well, it's a great book. And Lynn, thank you so much for writing it. Let me know the next book you write, and we'll get you back whatever it is. Thanks so much.
I really appreciate it, Larry. Thank you.
Lynn Peoples, her book is The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. Really fascinating. We didn't get into, we just touched the surface with her book. And so you'll learn a lot more if you read it. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mealer.